If you ache for truth, goodness, and beauty, if you're hungry for a Christianity with substance and strength, if you long for a faith that's big and bold and biblical and all about Jesus Christ, if you're inspired by the idea of one church that has spanned 20 centuries, 24 time zones, and two hemispheres, enfolding every race, nation, and language, then you're considering Catholicism. Welcome back to Considering Catholicism. My name is Greg. I'm your host, and I'm here with Corey.
Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. Well, actually, I think it's...
Oh, right. It is afternoon.
It is 12 o'clock exactly right now. So it's good afternoon, Corey.
Yes. And a good afternoon it is. I realize today it is March 26th. That's actually the 8th anniversary of us both becoming Catholics. We received confirmation and First Communion on this day in 2016.
That's right. Yes. All right. Well, here we are, 8 years in, and here we are. And we're going to take on a topic today. We've had a lot of listeners writing in about Eastern Orthodoxy, okay, the Eastern Orthodox churches. And so I promised we would do a couple of episodes trying to answer their questions, okay?
Yep.
Now, as soon as we get into this, there's this old phrase, like, that's ancient history. Like, let's not get into ancient history, but this is literally...
ancient, medieval, and modern. But yes, starting with history. The ancient, yeah.
So let's just start off and define it, because I think a lot of Americans, American Protestants, secular Americans, even American Catholics, don't even know what Eastern Orthodox
is. Kind of a fuzzy category.
Yeah, they've never encountered it. I was talking to somebody the other day, a Catholic, and I said something about Eastern Orthodoxy, and they looked at me like, what is that? And I go, the Greek Orthodox churches, and they're like, they sort of stared at me. Most of us don't encounter this on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, depending on where you live.
So Corey, why don't you give us a little bit of the background? What are the Eastern Orthodox churches? Where did they come from? What are they?
Sure. I'll try and keep it basic to begin with, because there's a lot you could include. But there are a number of churches, independent groups of Christians under bishops, that come out of the eastern part of what was the Roman Empire originally. So think Greece and Turkey and what's now modern day Israel and Lebanon and all of that part of the world, that are not in communion with the Pope, with the Bishop of Rome. The Catholic Church does recognize them as having valid bishops, valid priests, valid sacraments, but they are out of communion. The technical term is in schism. So they are Christians. There are many similarities between them and Catholics, but we are not united under normal circumstances. You couldn't receive the Eucharist together, that kind of thing. So there's a lot more to it than that, but that's the basics. There's, for instance, the Greek Orthodox Church in Greece. There's the Russian Orthodox Church in Russia. There's Antiochian Orthodoxy, which is named after Antioch, that ancient city, which we see even in the Acts of the Apostles. There are other Orthodox churches. A lot of them, you'll refer to them by the location, the place where it's originally from, but they exist in diaspora. So in America, there are Greek Orthodox, there are Ukrainian Orthodox, there are these churches or parishes that have been set up originally by immigrants or refugees that came from those places.
Okay. I'm going to come at this from a historical perspective.
Yeah. Well, I don't think you can understand it without doing that.
Yeah. So let me tackle this by telling the story. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I would say fast forward, but go back, wind all the way
rewind.
Back. Rewind.
Yes. If anyone knows what that is.
That's right. Yeah, right. Rewind all the way back to Jesus and the apostles, right? Jesus dies, rises again. We have Pentecost. The apostles go out and begin founding all these churches. And again, Paul, for example, as you say, goes all around Asia Minor and Greece and establishes all of these churches, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Fast forward from that a number of years or a number of centuries, that was the church. Mm-hmm. One of the arguments, I think, for the Catholic Church being the original church is that in the first centuries, there was only one church, one right. universal church, okay? Mm-hmm. Where there began to be a division initially was with Emperor Constantine the Great. So, Roman emperor, he was the first Roman emperor to convert to Christianity himself. Mm-hmm. and at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge and in Rome. And because of that, he then legalized Christianity throughout the empire, and he began to support it. Now, there is a narrative that Protestants like to believe that the original church was sort of like this proto-Protestant thing, right? It was all like a bunch of independent Bible churches.
Right, living in living rooms, yeah.
Yeah. And then what happened was Constantine came along and he established the papacy and the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Made it all icky and Roman.
Yeah. And supported, and yeah, so icky and Roman and supported by the government. Now that narrative is wrong because the Bishop of Rome was already had a supremacy, mm-hmm. okay? Didn't have the fully formed papacy, and he didn't have a big building in Rome. But when Constantine converted to Christianity, he also moved out of Rome. He moved to the eastern part of the empire, to what is modern-day Turkey, okay? Mm-hmm. To the place where modern-day Istanbul is. And he founded a city there called Constantinople. This would have been around the year 350. Mm-hmm. And he named it after himself, Constantine, Constantinople.
Like you do when you're emperor.
Yeah, when you're emperor. So he creates the city over there, and he then begins to establish churches there that are supported by the government. Mm-hmm. I mean, fully supported by the government. In fact, there were in ways the emperor gets involved in picking bishops and things like that.
Yep.
Okay? Meanwhile, back in Rome, the Pope is sort of left to himself. He got a building out of it, the Lateran Palace. Yeah, yeah. But basically the Pope, the Latin Pope in Rome, is sort of left to his own devices, and the papacy kind of grows up independent from that. And the Roman imperial apparatus and the Roman imperial support of the church is not in Italy and in the West. It's over in the East,
right.
in what is modern day Turkey and Greece and up into the Black Sea region, and as you described, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
Now, as time goes on, the gap between what we'll call the Western Church, the Latin Church, right? The mm-hmm. church in Italy and France and
that's
Spain.
That's Latin speaking and has a sort of common culture growing up as medieval Europe right. is getting on its feet.
Yeah. Now that Latin church, the gap between that and those Eastern churches gets bigger and bigger and bigger. In fact, sometimes this is called the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire. But mm-hmm. it's interesting. They never called themselves the Byzantines. What they called themselves was Romans.
Right. They considered themselves the Roman Empire.
They were the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire lasted in the East till 1453.
Yeah, more than 1,000 years after
more
Constantine.
More than 1,000 years yeah. after Constantine. The city of Constantinople fell to the Ottoman Turks in 1453. And then they changed the name of the place to Istanbul and all this kind of stuff. But that sort of Eastern set of churches and the culture that grew up around the Roman church over there, it was all Greek speaking, not mm-hmm. Latin speaking. And it developed this very different kind of culture and a very different kind of liturgy and a very different kind of organizational structure because it was heavily supported by the Roman government in the East.
Yeah. And for a very long time, I mean, there were certainly disputes between East and West. There were fights. There were times when churches over there weren't in communion with Rome, but it wasn't as if growing cultural and ecclesiastical differences automatically meant schism or imply that the churches necessarily had to be separate. They existed in intention, certainly, but in unity for quite a number of centuries.
Yeah. But let's give a couple of examples. Mm-hmm. And one I think that's an interesting example of these kinds of tensions is the iconoclast controversy.
Yeah, that's a big one.
So during the 400s, 500s, 600s, 700s, 800s, whatever, on and off, there were various Roman emperors in the East, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're
in Constantinople.
About, yeah, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about Byzantine emperors, or they call themselves the Roman emperors in the East, in Constantinople, who wanted to do away with icons, religious icons, mm-hmm. right? So statues and pictures of Jesus and the saints and Mary, which are venerated in the East as they are in the West.
Which was an ancient Christian tradition. You see right. them in the Roman catacombs from the beginning. Part of the impetus for the iconoclastic movement was Islam, the influence of Islam, which is a a distinctly iconoclastic religion.
And that was beginning to impinge the peripheries of their empire. Mm-hmm. But part of what's interesting about the iconoclast controversy in the East is that it's often driven by the emperors. Mm-hmm. Okay. In other words, it's driven by the secular rulers. And what they decide is, for a variety of reasons, that they want to start doing away with the icons and the elaborate decorations in churches. Maybe partly because of the influence of Islam, but also partly they wanted to reduce the power of the clerics. They want to reduce the power of the church, and they wanted to suppress certain aspects of the liturgy and worship. And this is always, again, interesting because it inverts the narrative that a lot of Protestants have, that the papacy in the West was always this thing manipulated by Constantine and the Roman emperors and the kings and all these kinds of things. It's actually in the West, the papacy that remains independent. It is in the East where the emperors and the secular leaders are always sort of messing with the church, always trying to intervene in it and try to, what? I don't want to say manipulate, but
meddle.
Meddle in it. And what happened is, on and off through these controversies, it was the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, the Pope in the West, the leader of the Latin Church, who upheld the use of icons and fought back against the Roman Emperor in the East and tried to continue supporting that. So there's an example of how complicated the church and secular politics of this whole thing got in the Eastern churches, but also an example of how the gap between the East and the West began to grow. Another one was just simply language.
Sure.
Yeah. So as time went on and you got into the quote-unquote, I'm doing scare quotes here, dark ages, but during the barbarian invasions and whatnot, there was not as much safe travel. And then when the Muslim conquest came about of the Mediterranean, it became less safe for people to travel from Italy to Constantinople. And so over time, over a number of generations, you don't have as many people on either side who speak the other language.
Right.
I mean, if you think about, today, you know, how many people speak Chinese? Well, we have a lot of people going back and forth between China. But back then, there weren't very many people going back and forth between the East and West. So the Greek churches could not speak Latin, and the Latin churches couldn't speak Greek, and there were very few people among them who could. And so whether it was iconography, liturgy, the involvement of the Roman emperors, the organization level of the church, language, culture, all of these things developed in very different ways. Mm-hmm. And lack of a better word, they grew apart.
Yeah. It's like anything. If you're separate and you're not communicating, it's going to be hard to stay on the same page.
Now, they grew apart, further and further and further apart. Of course, they all still worship Jesus and everything.
And there was formal communion between the churches.
Until that got ruined. Okay. And so let's get up to that, because there's a date that lives in history, and that is 1054.
And 1054 is important. I mean, it's not the only date to talk about the schism. I mean, in some respects, for several centuries, the schism played out until
The Photian schism in the 9th century. That was like a precursor to
And then even after, I mean, up until the 15th century, it wasn't set in stone that there was going to be this.
They had like the Council of
Florence. The Council of Florence tried to patch things up in the 1400s.
Yeah. But 1054 is the watershed date.
It's kind of a turning point.
So here's what happened in 1054. This controversy developed over a number of things. And one of them is, we have to get to this because we had a couple of listeners write in about it. And that is this thing called the Filioque Clause. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we'll explain it in a second. But between the Filioque Clause and a few other issues, in 1054, what happened was that a papal envoy, ambassador named Humbert, I think, he goes over to Constantinople and It was like a culture shock. So I was telling you the other day that the Byzantines were this like elaborate culture, right? The Romans in the East, they had all kinds of their palaces were amazing, their architecture, their art, including they had great skill with mechanical devices they called automata. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they had was, when you walked into the emperor's throne room, He had like this mechanical throne in hydraulics, and it would propel the emperor 30 feet in the air, so he was overlooking you. And then they had these giant gold and silver lions and birds, and they like would pump steam through them. So they were, and it was like really elaborate, and it was meant to like impress visitors. So this guy, Humbert, who's the envoy from the Pope, comes over there, and they've got to address these theological issues and this and that. And I guess the emperor elevated himself 30 feet in the air and turned on the Chuck E. Cheese mechanical lions and the whole bit. And it just like, it all went off really badly. And
yeah, it was like landing on an alien planet.
Yeah, and they didn't speak each other's language. And so anyway, to make a long story short, the papal envoy, of course, he couldn't email the Pope or call him on a sat phone.
Right.
What he did is he decided to excommunicate the emperor, I think it was.
Well, yeah, and then probably the patriarch of Constantinople.
The emperor and the patriarch.
Who would have been the bishop, right, essentially.
And then what they did is they excommunicated him. I think they excommunicated
the Pope right back.
Yeah, excommunicated the Pope. So what happened in 1054 is both sides excommunicated each other, and the whole thing just went really sideways and pear-shaped from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like we said before, there were ups and downs and developments for several hundred years before it was a full schism. But that was an important watershed moment in it happening.
Now, one of the things a lot of people ask is, well, what was the issue? What were the big issues? We get that the language is different and the architectural styles were different and the liturgy was a little different and this and that. But what were their actual substantive issues? So let's talk about this filioque clause.
Yeah. Before we go to that real quick, I mean, there certainly are substantive and doctrinal issues that people discuss. There are also just hurt feelings that makes it sound petty. Sometimes it's petty, but sometimes it's serious. I mean, there were things that happened during the Crusades where one side killed people and the other side killed people. And so there's historical hurts like that too.
Yeah, but I want to get to the reason I want to get to the substantive things is that when you explain it to people today and we say, well, the Orthodox churches and the Catholic Church are no longer in communion, you go, is everybody just like have like hurt feelings and the sads or something for 1,000 years? Because like at some point, are you going to get over the hurt feelings and the sads? So are there actual substantive issues? And we're going to get into this thing, the filioque clause, which was at least kind of the presenting issue for this.
One of the big ones.
One of the big ones. It's interesting whether the filioque clause in and of itself isn't even just a whole sort of hurt feelings thing. But let's get into that. You want to explain what the filioque clause is and how it came about?
So it's a clause or a part of a sentence in the Nicene Creed, except the whole issue here is that it was not originally in the Nicene Creed. So the Creed, which is a basic statement of Christian belief, which was developed in the early councils, the First Council of Nicaea, and then revised in the First Council of Constantinople.
Which, just by the way, is a suburb of Constantinople.
Right. So the first council was in Nicaea. The second one was in Constantinople. So they're right in the east.
Which is why the Eastern churches feel so defensive about the changes to the creed.
That's one reason. And just as an aside, it wasn't as if the Eastern bishops just got together and did it by fiat. There were Latin bishops there, of course. And then it presided over by papal authority. There was a papal delegate there, and it was confirmed by him in all of the councils. So that was conciliar and papal authority working hand in hand. But anyway, so the Nicene Creed was developed by the councils, and it came to be recited as part of the Mass, as part of the liturgy of the Eucharist. And then after a couple hundred years in the West, there was a development in which this additional clause was added. So you have longer struggles in the West with Arianism than you did in the East. Arianism is an early Christian heresy that denied Christ's divinity, said that he was essentially the highest creature rather than a full co-eternal God with the Father and the Spirit. The reason for that is because as you had pagan barbarian groups invading from the north and setting up shop and setting up kingdoms in the West, a lot of those rulers were converting to Arianism. And so it just drug on that the West was dealing with Arianism. And so a lot of the bishops originally in Spain added this clause to the Nicene Creed to basically give just an extra plug for the divinity of Jesus. So filioque means "and the Son." So it's in the part of the creed that says the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. So that's to just put an exclamation mark on the idea that Jesus is also God, just like the Father is, just like the Spirit, and the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. And so this arises in the West. It gets popularized in the West because it's an anti-Aryan measure. And then quite a bit later, several hundred years later, it's given full papal approval and is used in the Nicene Creed throughout the West and in the whole Latin Church. That's an independent development in the West. While all of the distancing that we were discussing is happening over hundreds of years, that's happening in the West and is not happening in the East. And so when people get down to it and are talking about this developing schism and are looking at the differences between the West and the East, the Eastern bishops are very upset about this. It was not made by the council. It was made by the bishops in the West without consultation in a council with the bishops of the East. The Pope, by his own authority, confirmed it in the creed. And that's another point of dispute, is the exact nature of papal authority. The Eastern churches don't have the same idea as the West. And so this was just not acceptable in their eyes and has become a major sticking point between East and West.
So if we look at the maybe, I mean, there's more than three maybe, but the three biggest tensions or the three biggest
disputes maybe.
Yeah, disputes between the East and the West on this. One would be papal authority.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they all get wrapped up together. So papal authority. So in the East, their notion is that you have these kind of like super bishops, like archbishops, like
patriarchs.
Yeah, patriarchs, yeah. Which are kind of like archbishops, kind of like metropolitan archbishops. And they sort of kind of rule through this consensus model.
Mm-hmm. Or they're sort of a first among equals. They're more honored than the others.
Yeah, right. And so there is no one over them. Now, I would argue that historically, the government from day one, from Constantine on, has been wrapped up.
And well, so it was the only authority that could knock bishops' heads together and make them play nicely.
Well, look at today in the headlines today. One of the disputes going on in the Ukraine and Russia right now is how the Russian Orthodox Church, which is part of these Eastern churches, mm-hmm. how the government has been wrapped up historically in the Russian Orthodox Church, the Russian government.
Yep.
And the Ukrainian government wrapped up in the Ukrainian church and these kinds of things. So there's this kind of weird history about that. Whereas in the West, it is the independence of the papacy that's not subject mm-hmm. to any secular ruler. And that's why the Vatican is its own nation state, mm-hmm. right? The Pope doesn't have to have an Italian passport. Right. He's an independent leader, ruler of the Roman Catholic churches around mm-hmm. the world. So papal authority is one. Secondly is this filioque thing. Mm-hmm. And that gets wrapped up with papal authority. Because if you listen to a lot of the Eastern churches, I can't say what they're really mad about. What it seems that they're really mad about is that it got added
without asking.
Yeah. They don't necessarily even dispute the issue because
some will, some won't. It's kind of a semantic matter.
Yeah, and yeah. I don't even want to get into this right now because it's sort of a semantic. It's a complex sort of philosophical argument about mm-hmm. how what they would say is that the Spirit proceeds through the Father from the Father through the Son, and mm-hmm. it just becomes this right. But the point is what they're really mad about is that the Pope added it to the creed without their permission.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing is priestly celibacy. Because in the West, in the late Middle Ages and so on, there was increasingly this move toward enforcing priestly celibacy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was on the authority of the Pope.
It had antecedents in the church, and even bishops in the East are mandatory
sure.
celibates. But it
was enforced by the papacy.
Right.
And so now, once again, a lot of this comes down to an argument over the legitimacy of the papacy.
And how much authority it has.
Whether that, because there were other things like in this Photian controversy in the 800s and these kinds of things where they were trying to replace a bishop or a patriarch, and the Pope tried to issue guidance on that, and we don't have to listen to you and all this kind of thing. So a lot of it really does come down to the issue of the papacy. Now, that becomes then played out in things like the filioque clause and celibacy and some of the other issues.
Right.
But a lot of it really, if you ask what's the thing that really divides the East and the West, it really does come down to the structure of the Western Church, which is unacceptable to the Eastern Church. It's unacceptable to have a pope. And again, that gets played out in things like the filioque clause. It gets played out in things like priestly celibacy and all these kinds of things. And the involvement of government into the church.
Sure. Well, then that's just a question of authority, too. Is it the Pope or is it the Emperor or the President of Russia?
I would argue that if you don't have a Pope, there's a vacuum. Somebody is going to step into that vacuum. And in the West, that is the papacy. And in the East, that vacuum gets filled by all sorts of other forces. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, all right, let's just kind of wrap this up because we're going to have a second conversation about this here in a moment. But let's wrap this up. So if somebody is listening who says, well, where would I see, like, where would I find like this Orthodox church? Are they in the United States? I mean, it seems like something that most people don't encounter.
Yeah. Like I alluded to before, there's a diaspora. So when Russians or Ukrainians or other Greeks or people from the Middle East ended up in the United States or other places, they brought their churches with them. So like in our, you know, little town in West Michigan, there's a small Antiochian Orthodox church. So that was originally the church in what is now, that'd be Syria, I think, Antioch in Syria. If you go to larger cities, there would be probably more different kinds. There might be a Russian Orthodox Church. There might be a Ukrainian Orthodox Church and others. So it does exist in the United States. It's not as common as finding a Catholic parish or a Presbyterian church, but around.
Well, anyone who ever saw My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and they will define themselves as a Greek Orthodox or Russian Orthodox or whatever, because there isn't this unified, they're not Catholic in the sense that the word Catholic means universal. They're not universal. They are a loose affiliation in some sense. And I hate to say this because maybe it's not what I say, but in some sense, it's kind of like Protestant denominations. They share.
There are some similarities.
In as much as they share common theological beliefs and practices, but they're different, almost denominations that work together. I mean, something like that.
Yeah. It's a limited analogy, but it gets you an idea.
Yeah. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a second conversation here because one of the questions that we get asked is, well, if I'm thinking about becoming Catholic, maybe I should think about becoming Orthodox instead of Catholic. Mm-hmm. So we're going to answer the question why 8 years ago you and I entered the Catholic Church instead of
Which we could have done.
All right. Join us for that. Hey, and if you're listening, thanks. And if you'd like to visit the website, consideringcatholicism.com, you'll see all of the episodes there organized and the archive categorized and whatnot. You can also contribute to the podcast. This is a ministry and we exist with your one-time or recurring donations. You can do that there. We would also really, really appreciate you rating and reviewing the podcast. If you are on Spotify or Apple or whatever, please give us a rating. That really helps us to move up not only in terms of visibility, but it qualifies us for other tiers of support and whatnot. And if you can give a review, especially on Apple Podcasts or on our website, we'd really appreciate that. And if you have a question that you'd like to ask or a comment you'd like to share, write me at consideringcatholicism@gmail.com. Okay. Thanks, Corey. Let's talk about why we entered the Catholic Church and not Orthodoxy.
All right.
Okay. Bye.